Will, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, there you are. Hi. How are you? Okay. Welcome to welcome to Authors on the Air, Will. I invited you here because I know you're a great Frank Sinatra aficionado. You've got his movies and his records, so I'm really glad that you're with me tonight to introduce our guest to the show, author David Lehman. David wrote a book called Sinatra Century, 100 Notes on the Man and His World. On the occasion of the centennial of his birth, everybody is just going crazy with all the Sinatra mobilia, I guess, going around and all the stories. I'm very excited to welcome to the show David Lehman. David, welcome to Authors on the Air.
Thank you, Pam. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so glad you're with us tonight. And, Will, you want to say hello to David, too?
Hello, David. Nice to meet you.
Pleasure's mine.
I'm so glad you both are here. David, one of my friends, and I'm sorry I don't remember which one it was, said that you were a terrific teacher. Would you tell us a little bit about what you taught?
Well, one course that I like to teach a lot is called Great Poems. And every week we study, a dozen great poems. And sometimes the students are asked to memorize a poem. And sometimes I have them imitate the poet. And I like the uncompromising nature of the title of the course, Great Poems. And the second course that I very much enjoy giving is called Literature and Ideas. And we begin with Genesis and the Odyssey and other great books that are too frequently neglected. And it's sort of amazing how few people have read Genesis and read some of the foundation books that make it a whole lot easier to read subsequent epic poems or romances or novels. But I also love writing about popular music, which is not my specialty by academic training, but it's a lifelong love of the classic American popular songs and their leading interpreters. And the greatest of them, I believe, is Frank Sinatra.
I believe you're right. Will, what do you think?
Yep, I have to agree wholeheartedly. there's absolutely no question that he left an impact that is still being felt today.
There are many.
You know, I was having lunch with Julius LaRosa, who was a wonderful singer in his prime. He's now well into his 80s. And alas, he may be most famous for having been fired on the air by Arthur Godfrey in a very mean-spirited way. But Julius said to me, Sinatra was number one, and the next best singer is number 37. And that was such a nice way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. David, where do you teach your classes at, by the way?
Well, now I'm teaching at the New School in New York City, in Greenwich Village.
Fabulous. Wonderful. Are you enjoying it?
Yes, very much. I've also taught at Columbia, which is my alma mater, and NYU.
Good grief. You are just steeped in that New York education. That's wonderful. Congratulations. Tell us how you came to write a book on Frank Sinatra.
Well, I've loved Sinatra's singing all my life, and I always knew I would write about him. In fact, I have. I've written articles for American Heritage and the New York Times and other places. And about more than that, back in 2008, I think it was, I was having lunch with a former editor, a good friend of mine, and she found out that I listened to Sinatra every day. And she said, oh, why don't you write a book? And I wrote a proposal, and my agent sold it. But I had the dickens of a time organizing it. I had a lot of material. I did a lot of research. I had a lot of new things to say. I had a lot of old things to say, I hoped in a new and compelling way. But how would I organize this? How would I write about someone about whom so many words have already been written? And I came on the scheme of writing the book as a, quote, century, an old literary form, meaning simply 100 parts. I thought I could write a book in 100 sections and time it to coincide with the 100th anniversary of the singer's birth on December 12th of 2015. And that was it. That was like the epiphany moment. I've had a number of epiphany moments with Frank Sinatra, like the first time I heard his version of I've Got You Under My Skin. And the idea that I could write it in 100 parts, there's so many angles to look at this man from. And 100 seemed perfect, that I could convey the career arc. I could talk about his music. I could talk about his personal life, his political life, his friendships, and so on. And once I made that decision, everything else flowed beautifully. It was wonderful. Whenever else, as a writer, do you get to put Sinatra on your record player or your CD player as you're writing a book? That's a double mm-hmm. treat.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Well,
and as a reader, I'm sorry, Pam?
No, continue. Because I have a question for you about
it. I was
going to
say, David, as a reader, I have to say the style with which your book was written was absolutely wonderful, because it was short little bites of the man's life, but it was enough to create a very compelling portrait of a man. And I have read, I think, just about everything there is, every biography, whether authorized or unauthorized. And quite honestly, I found your book to be absolutely fascinating.
Oh, I'm so glad to hear that. It means an awful lot to me. I've read most of the books on Frank myself, and I've enjoyed every one of them, even the ones that don't seem that sterling to me, because I'm so
mm-hmm.
interested in the man. But there have been some brilliant essays and books on Sinatra. He really does attract a literary mind.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
I know that you started to...
Yeah, before the show started, you were telling us, and then David and I, an interesting story about living in Las Vegas that made me very jealous. Will you recount that story?
Yes, absolutely. I'd be happy to. My family lived in Las Vegas from 1967 until my mother passed away in 1992. And we actually saw Frank Sinatra on stage. We saw Dean Martin live on stage. We moved there in 67. We just missed the Rat Pack era.
Wow.
But we did see the individual. We did see the guys. And it's something I didn't really appreciate it at the time, but looking back, oh, wow. What, you know, what a great memory.
Yeah. Wow.
Must have been fantastic. Who was he playing with? Was it the Count Basie band still in 67?
When he was at the Sands, yes. He was there with Count Basie.
Wow.
And then we saw him one time at Caesar's Palace. And I do not recall offhand who the conductor was.
Wow.
I don't remember.
That's
but I remember
memory.
Seeing him. We saw him at both places, at the Sands and at Caesars.
Oh, how lucky. And
mm-hmm.
When he was at Caesars, that must have been just around the time My Way was recorded.
I'll agree, because I'm not certain enough of the dates to disagree. But I'll say, yeah, that's got to be around the same time.
Wow.
When My Way was 69, 70?
I think it was 69.
Okay.
And I think it was recorded at the very last few days of 68.
Interesting.
Most of the biographies talk about why Sinatra left the Sands and went to Caesar's Palace. It was a sort of a major moment in Las Vegas.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. It was. There was a disagreement over a credit line, and Jack and Trotter, who was the floor manager or the casino manager, and Frank got into a physical altercation, at which point Frank said, okay, fine, and walked across the street to Caesar's Palace.
Really?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, there's, there's another version of the story that includes Frank getting punched in the jaw by
well, I was trying to, yeah, I was trying to leave it out, but yes, the story, the way I got it was Frank became so verbally abusive and so ugly that Jack and Trotter wound up and just punched him one. He gave him a good
one. Wow. Wow.
Well, yes, there's a story that Carl Cohen punched him in the jaw and broke several
teeth. I'm sorry, it was yes, you are correct.
And
I stand corrected, yes.
That's the amazing thing about Sinatra, is that he's a man of such incredible charisma, talent, musical genius, a genius for friendship, too, a great, generous man. At the same time, really could behave in an absolutely intolerable way. And he had many, many flunkies, and he also had many people who were intimidated by him. And then there were people who just deferred to him in the way that we defer to our geniuses. We give them a lot of room. But Frank really could behave in a monstrous way, and it's it's part of the wonderful, strange paradox that this voice that can sing so tenderly and also be the very incarnation of swing and can totally inhabit the song and extend its life as only a real artist and a visionary can do, it could also be a hoodlum in his temperament and behavior. It's it's really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
David, when
he was known for his temper.
When you began, when you began researching Frank Sinatra, there was already a lot of information out there about him. So you chose to write 100 bits of 100 little notes about him. How did you pick and choose which notes you were going to write? Did you pick some of the mundane that were very, very popular, but also choose to write some pieces that maybe were not as well known? Did you find stories that other authors hadn't touched on?
I believe that if you write a book about Frank Sinatra, there are certain characters, certain incidents, certain events that you cannot omit. They're just too central. You have to address Sinatra with the Harry James Orchestra, Sinatra with Tommy Dorsey, Sinatra with Columbia Records and on the radio in the 40s, Sinatra in relation to FDR seems to me to be an important subject, but maybe one that others don't see as just as inevitable as writing about Sinatra and Ava Gardner, which you cannot possibly overlook.
Share some of these stories and what you found most compelling and interesting, please?
I can tell you one story about Ava Gardner and Frank, but I don't know if the punchline would survive your radio censorship rule.
We don't have censors. We're not FCC governed. This is internet radio, so you're fine.
Well, Ava Gardner, who was the most beautiful woman in the world, arguably, was on location shooting a movie with the director of acclaim, John Ford. And someone mm-hmm. skeptically said to Ava Gardner that he couldn't understand what she saw in Sinatra, who he characterized as a 120-pound lout, you know. And
wow.
She shot back. She was quite a tigress, and she shot back. Says, Frank may weigh only 120 pounds, but 110 of them are pure cock.
Good
cover. Oh, boy.
He only weighed 120
now that's
pounds? Is that true?
His weight naturally fluctuated, and he weighed even less when he was in one of his frenetic states early on in the 1940s when he was really, really skinny. And it was part of his appeal because it stood for some quality of vulnerability, and it must have been one aspect of what attracted the Bobby Soxers, the young girls in their teenage years, to swoon over him, which they did quite authentically and set the pattern for later generations to moon over Elvis or the Beatles. He was very, very skinny. And if you go back to the radio shows of the 40s and comedy hours, they're always joking about Sinatra being skinny. And he and Bing Crosby used to sing these sort of parody duets. Yeah. And in one of them, Bing sings, how did that voice come from out of nowhere? Where the song Out of Nowhere is adapted to fit the circumstance in which a truly magnificent voice emerges from a mass of joints because he was so thin.
Oh, wow.
You know,
his
daughter, Tina, his youngest daughter, said of him that had her father been a less tortured man, a less nervous man, a less complicated man, why, he could have been Perry Como. And that seemed to me such a wonderful sentence that I made it a section of its own in my book. I haven't done the sentence justice, but just ad-libbing it instead of giving it word for word. But the point is that there are some wonderfully talented Italian-American singers of that period, Dean Martin and Vic Damone, and so many, and Perry Como, and yet there's what differentiates Sinatra from a great singer like Perry Como is not only that he's superior in his vocal range, or that his voice is richer, and he's a better interpreter of lyrics, all of which is true. But it's also that he's Frank Sinatra. There's something magical about this person and how this tortured personality, as his daughter put it, expresses himself in the music written by another person with the words by yet another person. So you may have Richard Rodgers writing the music. That is an incredible genius. And you may have Lawrence Hart writing the lyrics. Lawrence Hart is this witty and brilliant as the greatest poet, and you may have Nelson Riddle running your orchestra, and you have Frank Sinatra singing, and say it's the Lady is the Tramp, or My Funny Valentine. Why, the division of labor seems to me to be an extraordinary, exquisite artistic process involving a genius of a composer, a genius of a lyricist, a genius of a singer, the best musicians that you can possibly get under the best circumstances. And that's an art that will live for a very, very long time.
Well,
and it's,
may I ask, perhaps what made him stand out is, I think he had a presence, a command, commanding, I don't know, he commanded that people look at him. He had a presence. And while it's true that Vic Damone and Perry Como all had lovely voices and very strong and terrific voices, I don't think they demanded that people look at them, pay attention. I don't know. There was something about him.
I'll tell you another thing.
Sorry.
He had the knack of making a song sound like it was a chapter of his autobiography. Now, that's a very unusual thing to be able to do. He sings, "I'm a fool to want you," and he makes you feel that he knows heartbreak, that his heart has been broken. Nelson Riddle said that Ava Gardner taught him how to sing a torch song because of the extraordinary depths of despair that she sent him into. But if he sings "One for My Baby and One More for the Road," you're in the bar with the last drunk on his feet at a 2:45 in the morning. And he gets you to feel that. He likes to say, I've done my share of losing in my way. He even has a song called "Here's to the Losers." And it's sort of amazing to me that somebody who's a multimillionaire and is a great movie star, extremely powerful, very famous, would be able to sing a song saying, I'm a loser, and make you believe it. And you believe it for the length of the song, that, oh, this guy knows whereof he speaks. And one other thing I'll cite to differentiate him. Bing, who is great, and, you know, my love for Sinatra doesn't mean that I don't adore all these other singers who are, you know,
sure,
stars in my firmament. I cannot quite imagine Bing or Dean suspending their natural sense of irony enough to be able to sing "America the Beautiful" the way Sinatra does. Sinatra really believes the things that he sings. He'll sing a song in favor of tolerance, you know, "The House I Live In," which begins with the line, what is America to me?" And I can't imagine Dean singing that song or singing it quite with the conviction and earnestness of Frank Sinatra in that 1945 short, which he will again sing in the White House many years later, when Kennedy is president, and again when Nixon was president.
Interesting.
Now,
well,
I don't know if you agree, Will, but Sinatra...
Oh, absolutely. I was just thinking back to what you were talking about in terms of how it's like Frank could almost make you see the bar that he's standing in, and there's a very famous cartoon one time of two guys sitting in a bar, and they're obviously bedraggled and heartsick and, you know, all that. And Frank Sinatra's playing on the jukebox, and one of the guys says, "I wonder who he listens to."
Cute. It's good.
That's great.
I need to take a brief break right here to remind everyone this is a trademark copyrighted podcast solely owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network, LLC. I am speaking to the delightful David Lehman, who has written a beautiful book on Frank Sinatra called Sinatra Century, 100 Notes on the Man and His World. Please pick up the phone and call in. I will gift you a copy of David's book. The number is 347-633-9609. If you love Sinatra the way my guest co-host tonight, Will Graham, and I do, then you will want to say hello to David, who has so many stories to tell. The number again is 347-633-9609. The first caller gets a hardcover book written by David Lehman about Frank Sinatra. You know, I started taking piano and organ lessons when I was 5 years old, And my teacher was quite a bit older than I was. And so the songs that I learned were songs of my parents' era. And I learned plenty of Frank Sinatra songs. I don't know who wrote them and all, but they were Frank Sinatra songs. That's how I heard them, listened to them. So, it was really interesting to hear you talk about this. I feel like he's as much part of my upbringing as both of you. Hang on one second. We've got a caller. Hi, caller from area code 631. You're live. Who's this?
This is Reed Farrell Coleman.
Mr. Coleman, how are you this evening, sir?
How you doing, Pam?
I'm well. Reed is going to be joining me next Tuesday to talk about his fabulous books. I'm so excited about this. So what can we do for you tonight? Are you a Sinatra aficionado as well, Reed?
Well, I'm not a Sinatra aficionado. I'm a David Lehman aficionado.
There you go. That's who it was. I couldn't remember who said something to me.
Yes, David was my poetry professor at Brooklyn College.
Yes, we go way back.
Yes, way back. And I actually have a question for David. I didn't just call to say hi. I was wondering how somebody who was so into Wallace Stevens and Allen Ginsberg and John Ashbery made the transition, although I know David still does poetry, to Frank Sinatra.
Well,
interesting.
My love of Sinatra actually antedates my knowledge of the New York School of Poets, and around the time I discovered Walt Whitman, I discovered Sinatra's Swing, a record called Songs for Swinging Lovers, which I think is sort of a perfect expression of swing music. And it was around that time that I'd also begun writing poetry inspired by Walt Whitman, but they were very primitive efforts. But I knew Sinatra even from the time I was 8 years old, because I was at summer camp and they had a talent night, and a little girl named Anne and I were asked to sing Love and Marriage, which was the popular song of that summer. And then a couple of years later, you would hear these songs like All the Way, which was a big hit. So I heard it on my older sister's radio, and that was a Sinatra song in several senses. Not only did he introduce it and did it win the Oscar Award for Best Song, but it was written for him. That is, he, from the time he was very young, he had his own songwriting team. It was originally Julie Stein and Sammy Kahn.
Oh my gosh.
And then when Julie Stein went to Broadway to write Gentlemen Prefer Blondes and Gypsy, it was Jimmy Van Heusen and Sammy Kahn. So he had these people write songs for him, and inevitably they would write songs about him. So if he, he used this very funny lingo, and he had a phrase, ring-a-ding-ding. And
yes.
So sure enough, Sammy Kahn and Jimmy Van Heusen cook up a song called Ring-a-Ding-Ding, which is, it's not a bad song. It's pretty good. It's not one of their absolute greats, of which there are many.
Wow.
That's a long-winded response.
That's okay. Will, you had something to say?
Yes, ma'am. I'm just listening. I'm just enjoying the conversation.
Reed, are you a Sinatra lover at all?
Well, I grew up with Sinatra. My parents were Sinatra lovers.
Right.
So
right.
I had
never mind.
Choice. But I'm kind of fascinated with the, well, of course, I write hard-boiled and noir. So, of course,
yes,
I'm kind
yes,
of fascinated
do.
With the darker side of Sinatra and the late 60s Sinatra.
Yes.
When he was, when he was kind of no longer hip, when he was struggling to find material to do that seemed relevant. You know,
yeah.
I'm interested in that Sinatra also.
And also, Reed, I think you would like his treatment of songs that can only be considered noir, like Body
like
and
Mrs.
Soul.
Like Mrs. Robinson.
well, that's
no
material
boy.
That's not really right for him. And
right.
It's unfortunate that the musical world changed so radically that Sinatra had only one really great mega hit after 1970, and that's New York, New York,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, is the theme song of the city. So that's quite
sure.
an accomplishment.
You know, you were talking earlier, David, about One for My Baby and One More for the Road. I have to tell you something, that I watched the very last episode of Johnny Carson, and that was his favorite song of all time, and Bette Midler sang that song. If Sinatra had been reincarnated in a female body, it certainly would have been in Bette Midler's body, the way she sang that song. I don't know if you ever, if you saw that episode. It was absolute. I was holding my breath. Carson was crying. It was absolutely amazing. It was just a stunning thing. It's just something I thought I'd throw in there. But Reed, stay
That's
on,
great.
And we'll stay on, because I have a I
you,
have another
you know that
question.
Johnny Carson and Johnny Carson and Frank Sinatra were friends.
Yes.
Off stage, and yes. Sinatra frequented a bar called Jilly's, and it was owned by a very close friend, and Sinatra was sort of the king of the hill, and a lot of mob guys went to Jilly's. And
exactly
Johnny Carson,
what I was going to ask you about. I
want
to know
Carson
about Sinatra and the mob. Did he really?
Well, yeah, when one night Johnny Carson was flirting with a very nice young woman at Jilly's, but he didn't know that that woman was involved with a made man from a gang. And Johnny
wow.
Carson got thrown down a flight of stairs.
Really?
Had to stay in his apartment for a few days before it got sort of clarified. Johnny Carson introduced the Rat Pack at a St. Louis concert in, I think it was 66, and naturally I think Dean is the first to perform, and then Sammy, and before Sinatra goes on, Johnny Carson introduces him as our hoodlum singer.
Oh,
and
lovely.
Yeah, they're having a very good time. This is on a
mm-hmm.
CD that's available.
That's funny. Let's take another call.
Yeah, you're going to ask about the mob.
I will.
You know,
hold on 1 second. Let's take this call from area code 678. You're live on the air. Who's this? You're on the air live. Area code 678. Hello. Okay. Call back. I'm sorry. Go ahead, David. Someone got shy and didn't want to talk to me. Stay
yeah,
on,
if
stay
I could tell.
Read. Yeah, go ahead and tell us about the mob.
Well, you know that to this day there are thousands of gullible people who believe that to get the part in From Here to Eternity that rescued his career, a goon beheaded a horse and deposited the head of the stallion in the bed of a Hollywood director. Now, this is
The Godfather.
It's a scene in The Godfather. Well,
sure.
But the point is that at two crucial moments in Frank Sinatra's meteoric career, when he left the Tommy Dorsey band and got out of a contract to go out on his own and become Frank Sinatra rather than part of the Dorsey Orchestra, and the second major time when he got the part of From Here to Eternity. In both cases, there have always been rumors that the mob was involved in getting him his way,
wow.
that a gun was either held to the forehead of Tommy Dorsey or shown to him, or But there, you know, there are dozens of stories, and it's sort of impossible to know exactly what happened. There's a story that Ava Gardner was instrumental in getting him the part in From Here to Eternity, where he plays Maggio, a very mm-hmm. sympathetic character, a victim of a bully, an Italian-American, perfect to revive Frank's image, and he gets to die on screen, which is terrific for an American man who is going to get off the mat, you know. How did he get that part? Was it the Godfather who stepped in? Was it Ava Gardner's influence? It's hard to know for sure. But Sinatra did hold in great esteem the men of the what we call the mob, the mafia, because they were heroes in their neighborhoods at a time when Sinatra was growing up, and to be a, quote, Dago or a Guinea or a greaseball or a wop was, you know, meant that you were the victim of bigotry. You know, it was not an easy time in some ways, and in such a community, the successful men of the mob were often, you know, sort of benefactors and seen as heroic rebels. And at any rate, Sinatra did get to meet Lucky Luciano and was photographed with him in Havana in 1948. And all the gossip columnists loved Sinatra because he was always news. He was always making news one way or another. And here was another. And right-wing columnists of the 1940s loved writing about Sinatra because they could denounce him. They could say that he was shirking his responsibilities because he was not in the army. They were jealous because the girls loved him. They thought he was a red because he sang "The House I Live In." They thought he was a gangster because he was seen with Lucky Luciano. These are all sort of interesting aspects of a personality.
Very interesting. Will, do you have questions or comments?
I'm just listening. Everything David has said is interesting. I've heard many, many different stories about both incidents, about how Frank left the Tommy Dorsey band and how he got the part of Maggio. I would like to believe, as far as the part of Maggio goes, that Ava Gardner helped him more than anything else. But that's just me. Out of all the stories, I would like to believe that one.
I agree. That's a much more romantic solution to the mystery. And also, their affair was as intense and heated as could be. I think only Richard Burton and Elizabeth Taylor were that incandescent. I mean, they were apparently drawn to each other, mm-hmm. and were, you know, they were sexually dynamite. But at the same time, they were quarreled all the time. It's like can't live with them, can't live without them.
Yes, agreed.
I want to kind of bring this conversation about Sinatra into the present, because there are so many who are younger than Sinatra's generation who just love and adore him. Harry Connick Jr. has made his living off being kind of a Frank Sinatra type. I told you about the story from NPR that I listened to from Radiolab about a guy who's got the vocal chops that you'd swear was a young Frank Sinatra. Literally, they played his music and Frank Sinatra's music side by side. It was just amazing. Why is that? Why do you think? Reed, you know, you and I are of a generation where we like kind of the newer people, too. I mean, I like Harry Connick. I think he's great. What do you think? You think that the music is carrying over now and will continue on and on? That there'll always be wannabes or copy singers or
well,
you know, maybe it's the simplest form
of
flattery.
I think technology actually has a lot to do with it.
Really?
I think the availability of music. I mean, my kids are, you know, my daughter's 26, and she loaded my iPod, and on my iPod was a lot of Sinatra, right? This was her music. She didn't load
really?
This for me. Yeah. So I think that one of the ways that, you know, the Beatles, you know, the people from my, you know, the Beatles, the Stones, whatever,
sure.
will persist
right.
because of the technology. And I think the same is true of Sinatra. Whereas I think Bing Crosby, who was a great singer, kind of will fade. Because
he didn't have the persona. Yeah.
Yeah, he didn't have the persona, and he died also. Sinatra, I think, is the person from that generation who will persist.
Yes, I think you're right. Will, David, you
he was fairly talented.
Oh, absolutely. Frank Sinatra is eternal, and he always will be.
And, you know, Will,
you said
before that when he sang One for My Baby and One More for the Road, that Harold Arlen, Johnny Mercer song, that you could visualize the bar. He brought the
mm-hmm.
bar to life. And I would go further and build on that and say, and you could see his fedora and trench
yes.
coat. And
yeah,
the
absolutely.
Glass and the cigarette. And it's,
mm-hmm.
and you can see him hold the match for two bars. It's in fact, there is footage of him doing it on television. And,
yes.
He turns the 4 minutes of the song into a short story, like a Hemingway story.
It's a video. It's a video, an all-time video, the way he does that. You know,
and
what
it's,
our modern
it's a,
music
it's
videos
journey.
Would be. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well,
amazing.
If you don't mind me jumping in, Pam, I have to
absolutely.
Say that the
in.
Thing I think David made this point before is that interpret, you know, I'm going to make an odd comparison. For our generation, for my generation, there were great interpreters of songs who could take a song by this person and absolutely make it his own.
Yes.
And that person for my generation would be Joe Cocker. When Joe
yes.
Cocker, I mean, I'm not comparing their voices or their talent, but one
I
talent
understand.
They shared was that they could play someone else, sing someone else's song, and, you know, the arrangement and the musicians helped,
sure.
of course, but the style absolutely made it his own. And I think Sinatra, whatever song he sang, had a gift for making it him. You know, you swore that song was his.
I agree with you. So let me ask you three gentlemen, how do we explain the phenomenon that is Tony Bennett, who continues to sing into his 80s and sings with, 20-year-olds and is still very, very popular?
Mm-hmm. Well, some people have said to me, Tony Bennett's back, and my response has always been, he never left.
Away. Exactly.
He never left. But he's always been.
You've got to be very happy for Tony Bennett because he was a wonderful singer in the 50s and 60s, and he had some really tremendous hits, and that's when his voice was at its best. That tenor voice, and Sinatra really liked him best of all the up-and-comers because of the drama that Tony could put into his singing. But he fell on very, very hard times.
Yeah,
like many of the singers who were suddenly out of work, like the songwriters who, you know, suddenly there was no demand for an Irving Berlin song or a Harold Arlen song. and Tony Bennett and Mel Torme and other singers didn't know, had no work. So Tony was really in the basement and in a pretty desperate way. And so the idea that he would have a comeback in the, you know, in the 80s, and one of his really good albums from that period around 1989, 90 was called Perfectly Frank, and he sang all these Sinatra songs.
Yep.
And Tony, he must be nearly 90, so God bless him.
He still does in concert. Mm-hmm.
Oh yes,
that's
and
right.
I think that's a big. I think to kind of boomerang off what David was saying, I think that's part of Tony Bennett's appeal is he's one of the last links that we have to that whole era.
I believe so too.
So he's one of the last ones left.
I know it's so sad. A couple of years ago, Joe Stafford died, and there are very few. Kim Novak is still with us. Doris Day is
right.
still alive, speaking of very underrated singers.
Betty White,
yes.
who's not a singer, but she's still as popular
still,
or more
yes.
popular than she ever was. So
I think Tony
you know,
Martin might still be alive. He was the husband of Sid Charisse, the greatest
yes.
dancer.
Yes.
Oh, she was amazing.
She was magnificent.
Ooh,
yes. yeah. We're almost out of time, and I hate for this to end because I love this conversation. We've got how blessed am and lucky am I? I've got David Lehman, who's written this magnificent book, who's a scholar who teaches poetry and Jewish songs and talks about literature. And what a delight.
And I believe
an
he's an Edgar nominee.
And an Edgar nominee. There you go. I've got Ree Carol Coleman, who's won every award that any mystery or thriller author could ever win. And he's my guest next Tuesday. My dear friend Will Graham, who writes the most astonishing books in the Spider series, is part of the Edward Fallon Linger group. And is just a pretty damn good friend of mine anyway. I've got the best job in the world, folks. Final thoughts from you, Reed, before we wrap.
Well, I love listening. I always tell the story that I wouldn't be a writer if it wasn't for David Lehman. So, I would not have... Because David did something when I was in his class that he forgets that he did. But he made he made us take an oath that from that day forward we would think of ourselves as writers. That no matter what we did to earn a living, that we would always think of ourselves as writers.
What a glorious thing.
Yeah,
what
that profoundly changed my life. So
I bet it did.
Yeah.
Reed Farrell Coleman, thank you so much for being with me. I can't wait to talk to you on Tuesday. Have fun on Friday night. Love to the family. And you and
all
I
right.
will be chatting
thank
on Tuesday. Okay,
right.
thanks
you
for
guys.
Joining
bye,
us.
Bye, David. Bye, Will.
Take
well,
care.
I just want to say, Pam, you have some wonderful
yes.
friends.
I do. Aren't I lucky?
Great friends.
I
yes,
do.
You're very lucky.
My And I hope that you'll consider me your friend too, David. I have so enjoyed this conversation. I want you to come back and talk some more. And just even if we do a conference call with Will, I want to hear more stories. Because truly, what a fascinating, fascinating look at this icon. A really, truly a cultural icon in, you know, for the 1900s, there's no doubt. Boy, thank you so much for taking the time, David Lehman, to be with me. Folks, the name of the book is Sinatra's Century, 100 Notes on the Man and His World. And boy, if that's not an appropriate title when you talk about Frank Sinatra, I don't know what is. David Lehman, thank you for being with me. Happy New Year and much, much success with this book. You certainly deserve it.
Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure. The conversation's delightful, and what a great surprise to have Ree Coleman turn up on the phone and say such nice things about me.
Oh, I'm so glad he did. I knew that someone was going to hear that you and I were speaking and that Will was joining us and he would call. I just didn't know who it was, but I'm so glad that he called in. And how funny that he's coming in next Tuesday to as my guest. I'm really excited. So maybe you'll call in then and say hello to him. Hey?
Yes, okay. That was a very, very pleasant surprise.
That was nice. Thank you so much, David.
I'm going to excuse myself and let y'all wrap up.
No, you stay
I'm
here,
sorry?
Will. You and I are going to stay with me for a minute. You and I are talking. David,
okay,
thank you so much. Come back and
welcome.
Can you write another book? Come back and talk to me, will you?
It'll be a pleasure.
Thank you so much.
David, it was a genuine pleasure. I really enjoyed meeting you, David.
Good night, David. And my favorite co-host of all time and my good friend, Will Graham. Will,
yes,
I swear you weren't kidding when you said this was going to be a good one. You know, this is going to be one
for
the
ages. I couldn't wait for it. I knew this was going to be exciting.
Yeah.
What
David's great story.
Book, it's wonderful. And the greatest thing to me about David's book is it's we touched on it briefly, but it's like 100 little bites of
it's like
Frank
an
amuse
bush. You have all these little appetizers, these tapas laid out on a table,
right,
and you get to sample all this wonderful thing that he's talked about.
I was flipping through it before the interview just to refresh myself, my memory, and I noticed some of the chapters are maybe one paragraph.
That's what
some of the
said,
chapters
yeah,
are two
thought.
Pages.
Mm-hmm.
And
they're wonderful.
Calling it an amuse-bouche is very accurate because it's just little bits and pieces of the man's life.
Yes.
But if you put it all together, you get a feast.
Yeah,
you have a wonderful
really
story.
Do. I'm
and,
so glad you joined me because, you know,
thank you so much for the invitation. I was very
it's
flattered.
My pleasure. We'll do this again soon, yeah?
You betcha.
Thank you, Will. Have a good night, my love to Donna.
Thank you, Pam. You too. We'll
good
talk
night.
Soon.
There you
good
go.
Good night.
And thank you for being with me tonight, folks. I'm taking Friday off. How about that? But next week, man, have we got a lineup for you. On Monday, we are doing, Chris Irvin's going to come in. Oh, my God, he is so good. On crime fiction, noir crime fiction. He's amazing. Reed Farrell Coleman on Tuesday, as you heard. Wednesday, I'm sitting in with Tom Pitts on Skid Row Chatter. We're going to be talking to Josh Stallings and to Steve Loudon. And then on Friday, the magnificent James Ziskin and his thrillers. It's going to be a great week of radio. Thank you for being with me tonight. And thank you, Mom and Dad. Good night, everyone.